From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. A new report by the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, has found that anti-Semitic incidents in the United States rose nearly 60% in 2017. The whopping rise in racist incidents against Jewish Americans is the largest single-year increase on record and the second highest number reported since ADL started tracking such data in the 1970s. The surge of white supremacist groups in the U.S. and the concurrent rise of Donald Trump's political power represent a dangerous reality that is literally a matter of life or death for vulnerable communities in the U.S. But Trump and his ilk claim they're not racist. Indeed, Trump has said he is, quote, the least racist person. Joining me to help analyze all of this is Tarso Ramos, Executive Director of Political Research Associates, which produces investigative research and analysis into the U.S. right and supports social justice advocates defending human rights. Tarso Ramos has been investigating and challenging the U.S. right for 25 years, and under his leadership, PRA has launched major initiatives on Islamophobia, anti-Semitism, misogyny, authoritarianism, white nationalism, and the alt-right. Welcome to the program, Tarso Ramos.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. So the Anti-Defamation League's new report about the sharp rise in anti-Semitic incidents in 2017, a 60% rise in 1 year. They're saying that since the time they began taking the data, they have never seen such a sharp rise. Are you at all surprised by this finding?
I'm sorry to say I'm shocked but not surprised by this finding, which is entirely consistent with acts of ethno-violence, harassment, and intimidation directed at other targeted communities, including Muslims, South Asians, Latinos, and others. We've seen an unprecedented spike in such crimes in 2017. And in the case of crimes targeting Muslim Americans and those perceived to be, we're talking about levels that exceed even the immediate post 9/11/2001 period. And it's unsurprising, of course, because a climate fostering the targeting of vulnerable communities has been created through the context of the 2016 presidential campaign and by the ongoing disparagement and targeting and demonization of these communities from a variety of sources, but most notably by the president of the United States, Donald Trump.
Would you say that we're at a moment where vulnerable communities are really facing a life or death situation? You know, we have immigrants in the country that fear ICE coming to their door and separating them from their young children. And for those people in schools, such as the victims of the Florida shooter who were killed in a way that might have been fueled by his racial hatred, we're literally talking life or death.
We are not only talking about a climate of unprecedented intimidation and violence, we are really talking about a moment in the history of this country where the question about who we are as a people who gets to be an American is an active and violent contestation. I would argue that the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States, albeit not in the popular vote, but through the Electoral College, brings with it unprecedented levels of threat to the civil, human, and constitutional rights of the people who reside here, and that there is an active question as to whether democracy as we imagine it in the United States will survive as whites become a numerical minority some decades from now. What Donald Trump represents, among other things, is an effort to prepare the country for conditions of white minority rule, in my view.
White minority rule. So he spoke very recently at the Conservative Political Action Committee, the CPAC conference, which is this annual gathering of conservatives from around the country. In fact, this year, Richard Spencer, probably one of the most high profile overt racist white supremacists, was not allowed in, but others argued that there were other people who were allowed in, very similar to him. And of course, the president himself spoke. I want to play for you and our audience a short excerpt of a video of Trump's speech where he improvised. Instead of his scripted speech, he decided to read a poem called The Snake that he had read at previous political campaigns and decided to share it once again, apparently by popular demand. Here's Donald Trump.
But instead of saying thank you, that snake gave her a vicious bite. Take me in, O tender woman. Take me in, for heaven's sake. Take me in, O tender woman, sighed the vicious snake. I saved you, cried the woman, and you've bitten me, heavens why. You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm going to die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in.
And that is Donald Trump speaking at the Conservative Political Action Committee. We only played the second half of his poem there. Tarso Ramos, this poem is actually, it's the lyrics of a rock and roll song sung by a black singer named Al Wilson, and it's called The Snake. And Trump read it to portray the snake as the immigrant and the woman who brings the snake in and gives him shelter, who's then bitten by the snake, as the white American victim. I don't know if that song was ever meant to be told in that way.
Well, it's a colorful illustration of a point that Donald Trump has made consistently since the beginning of his presidential campaign, and in certain ways before that, in which Trump represents Muslims, immigrants, at least those from the global south. Of course, we know the president has more colorful term of art for global south countries than that, is dire threats to white America and to white womanhood. The characterization beginning on the opening day of his presidential campaign depicting Latino immigrants to the United States as rapists and criminals is entirely consistent with white supremacist themes from the Deep South in times of slavery, depicting Jim Crow militias as important to protect white womanhood and purity. So Donald Trump evokes all of these kinds of memes and messages that come from the history of white supremacy in the United States on a regular basis. You mentioned Richard Spencer, and of course there were others who were in fact invited to CPAC this year, including the niece of Marine Le Pen, who leads the National Front in France, and the granddaughter of the founder of the National Front was invited to CPAC as well. And it's worth mentioning that in a way on the far right, there's kind of a debate now between those in the more mainstream of influence within the Trump administration, particularly with respect to policy on immigration and on Islam, in the alt-right or the openly white nationalist right, sort of a debate between whether the future of the United States is one of white domination, even as whites become a numerical minority on the one hand, or whether white numerical majority will be maintained through a process of elimination, which of course is what Richard Spencer and white nationalists advocate. And those are the two poles of debate between what's now in the center with the Trump administration and what's on the far right of the administration with Richard Spencer and other avowed white nationalists. Not a very sanguine spectrum of debate for anyone who believes in the principles of democracy, and particularly anyone who's committed to multiracial democracy in our future.
I want to go back to this poem that he read and the symbolism of a woman, since you were referring to how he basically genderized the anti-immigrant rhetoric during his campaign. In the poem, he reads, a woman takes in a snake who then bites her and kills her. And this is exactly the kind, I mean, it's one thing for him to have this, read this during his campaigns to whip up a base that can vote him in. It's another thing for him to actually do this as president. He has said, I'm the least racist person you'll ever meet. Because, of course, somehow, against all odds, the word racist is still a dirty word. That may be, you know, that may change. But what does his invocation of this poem as president signal to his base?
Look, Donald Trump, since becoming president, has not stopped broadcasting white nationalist ideas and memes and messages, his giving cover to the white nationalist, the murderous white nationalist rally in Charlottesville is a very well-known example of that. And while these kind of extreme statements and extreme positions of Trump are indeed worrisome, in some ways, even more concerning to me is the fact that his administration is now being advised by long-term, hardcore, anti-immigrant strategists whose goal is to maintain the cultural, political, and numerical dominance of people of white European descent in the United States. Where we once spoke of a kind of anti-immigrant lobby in Washington, D.C. that exercised influence through Congress, we now see that these people have moved directly into the administration. We have people like the former executive director of the Federation of American Immigration Reform, Julie Kirshner, as the ombudsperson at the U.S. Center for Immigrant Services, Customs and Immigrant Services. We have people like Stephen Miller, who came to the campaign and then the senior advisor position in the White House by way of being a staff member to Jeff Sessions, who is an integral part of the anti-immigrant lobby in Washington, D.C. And so these people have regular access to the White House, in fact, hold positions in the executive branch and are influencing, in fact, setting the platform for the executive branch's immigration policy. So they've moved from simply trying to limit flows of unauthorized immigrants to now looking to change the process of visa allocation and authorized immigration,
right,
in order to favor European immigration of European descent. So we have the structural shifts in the administration's policy are as worrisome as these kind of outrageous statements of demonization that Trump continues to make.
And these legal forms of immigration are one that many in the administration themselves have used to bring their own family members. But of course, it's okay because they're white. How important is it for us to also understand that when Trump uses this dangerous rhetoric to whip up frenzy among his base, he is doing so to a base that is well armed? We tend to treat the scourge of gun violence as separate from the scourge of white supremacy, but aren't they deeply linked?
Well, certainly they are deeply linked. And we have seen over the past couple of years a resurgence of right-wing paramilitary groups, some of them avowedly white nationalists, like those who held the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville and similar mobilizations in other places, Shelbyville, Murfreesboro, and so forth. And we've also seen the resurgence of so-called Patriot Movement paramilitaries, groups like the Three Percenters and the Oath Keepers, who claim not to be white nationalists, but have found themselves cooperating in mobilizations directly with white nationalists and openly fascist organizers. And most disturbingly, mobilizing in ways where they're in cooperation with local municipal police forces, for instance, at a demonstration in Portland, openly cooperating with police to subdue counter-protesters. And so in this moment of Trumpism, we see not only a rise of the far right, including an armed far right set of forces, but increasing collaboration with the repressive policing apparatus of the government.
And that's really important. You're actually in Southern California. The day that we're talking to you, you're going to be doing an event with the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition that draws a lot of these issues to the forefront. And that's something I think that even the left has to sort of grapple with. Or when I say the left, maybe I should say liberals have to grapple with, because there's this mainstream America tends to want to draw a line between policing and white supremacist violence. But there are a little bit, there's more overlap than we'd like, right?
There is unfortunately significant organizing within law enforcement, particularly at the local level, by the far right. And so we see not only examples of county sheriffs all over the country, Joe Arpaio was perhaps the most infamous of these, but there are many others.
The Arizona sheriff, yeah.
The Arizona sheriff who's now running for Senate, a federal Senate in the state of Arizona, after being pardoned for his crimes by Donald Trump upon his election. But we see other sheriffs around the country who have stepped up and volunteered, for instance, to send their imprisoned inmates to build Trump's southern border wall. These are sheriffs who stand directly to profit from detention incarceration of immigrants. And in some cases, these are sheriffs who are members of a far-right paramilitary organization called the Constitutional Sheriff and Peace Officers Association, which is the sister organization to the Oath Keepers paramilitary group. There also, of course, is an unfortunate and long history of far-right organizing within municipal police forces. So the places now where there's a nexus between far-right organizing and law enforcement and the repressive initiatives of the state with respect to detentions and arrests of immigrants, the targeting of immigrant rights organizers around the country, which we've seen, the use of the so-called countering violent extremism program to spy on and to interrogate and to repress Muslim and Hmasa communities around the country.
Somehow violent extremism doesn't cover white supremacist extremism.
Indeed, and in fact, the administration has sought to further politicize this program within the FBI so that it essentially doesn't pay attention to white nationalists or white supremacist organizing and directs all of its resources towards surveilling and policing Muslim populations.
Right. And we've seen reports showing that of all of the mass shootings that have happened in the past several decades, a majority are committed by white males. That should be something that the FBI should look at and has in the past. But certainly under this administration, that goes out the door. One of the issues that I want to bring up is how people are fighting back, even among authorities. There was a very interesting story recently of Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf, who was tipped off by ICE that the Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE, the enforcement arm of Homeland Security, was going to be conducting a raid in Oakland. And she took the rare step of issuing a warning to the residents of her city. And we know now after the raid that did happen that 800 people were spared being rounded up and detained for deportation by ICE. That is a huge number of lives that she basically has helped out. How important are actions like this? And by the way, she herself might be facing legal action for what she did.
I think it's an incredibly courageous stand. And I hope that other municipal leaders around the country and others in civic leadership, whether they are presidents of universities or high school principals or officials in hospitals, will take courage from her example. I do think it is inevitable that the Trump administration will try to make an example of her and punish her. And there have been accusations that her behavior was treasonous and so forth. And so I'm sure that many officials will be watching that carefully. But this is a moment in which we need many more types of people and actors who are in positions of leadership to take courage and step forward and resist the widespread demonization and targeting of vulnerable communities. And so I'm heartened by her action and hope that others will follow in her footsteps.
And California in general seems to be a favored target of Trump, given how few Californians voted for him and how even officials in California have spoken out about his policy, spoken out against them. It's widely seen as the forefront of the geographic forefront, if you will, of the resistance to Trump. And it's not, we shouldn't be surprised that it's also being targeted for what seems to be the largest number of raids by ICE. In a way, he's wielding immigration enforcement as a weapon.
That's right. It's not the only policy area in which Trump has sought to punish states and municipalities that he sees as antagonistic to his administration's goals. We saw that in terms of his tax policy and in other areas. But the administration has declared, and we've seen this in the examples you've just offered, that they aim to punish jurisdictions, whether they're cities or states, that offer sanctuary and that resist cooperation with his agenda for arresting, detaining, deporting unauthorized immigrants. And with the Supreme Court's ruling just the other day, which authorizes indefinite detention, even of green card holders, the stakes truly have risen. And so I think that we are likely to see more of the kinds of raids that you were describing, and not only in California. Fortunately, we've seen widespread resistance to the Trump administration agenda with respect to assailing MASA or Muslim and Arab communities and other immigrants across the country, not just in California, not just on the coasts. And it's an extraordinary number of municipalities that have declared some version of sanctuary.
How important is it for us to name not just Trump, but all of those around him, not just part of his administration, but his party as well as part of the problem? Because it's tempting for us to think, all right, in the next elections, we'll have Democrats possibly in power, and then maybe we'll elect a Democrat into the White House 2 years later, problem over.
Problem will not be over. I don't think that the toothpaste goes so easily back into the tube after Trump's election. A few things to say about this. One is that the Republican Party, the GOP, increasingly resembles hard right European policies in making really strident anti-immigrant and racial nationalist policies a litmus test for participation in that party. It's long been the goal of the organized anti-immigrant movement, the nativist movement rooted in Washington, D.C., and represented through groups like the Center for Immigration Studies, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and others, to move the GOP into that position and to try to make immigration a partisan issue in that way. To try to make the Republican Party embrace hardcore anti-immigration and anti-Islam policies as fundamentalists say their opposition to reproductive choice for women. I wouldn't say that they've fully consolidated that position. There are still factions within the Republican Party, but they've gotten awfully close to that. And we see that in this moment as DACA, the Protection for Dreamers, is being used as a bargaining chip to try to change the entire immigration strategy of the United States to favor immigrants of European descent. So that's one thing that I think is not likely to change very quickly. It will be very hard to return to the kind of pre-Trump politics with respect to immigration policy going forward. The second is, as the United States approaches the demographic tipping point, where whites are no longer, at least whites as currently defined, are no longer a numerical majority in the United States, I would expect that racial anxiety and the ability of not just Trump, but many other nativist organizations to mobilize racial fear will only increase rather than decrease. Trump himself in his election in some ways is both a symptom of these deeper fears and anxieties and mobilization by the far right in the United States, and a force multiplier to those same anxieties. But if Trump goes away, the conditions that make that kind of politic ripe in the United States don't disappear with him.
Finally, Tarso Ramos, you are the executive director of Political Research Associates, which produces investigative research and analysis on the U.S. right. But today we are in an era of the power of fake news being able to propel greater polarization. Is the prevalence and the influence of fake news overblown, or is this a real issue that we have to take on in our, you know, in our organizing?
We do know that an increasing number of people in this country and around the globe rely on social media as the source for their information and analysis, in that social media has been a set of platforms particularly ripe for ideological manipulation in an arena in which far-right organizers have been particularly effective at sowing propaganda as though it were actual information and analysis. So that is a very real problem. It is a very real problem. Part of the strategy of civil rights organizers and human rights organizers in the U.S. over the past decade has been to isolate and to marginalize the influence of organized nativist groups with what we would now refer to as legacy media. In the same period of time, the influence of the so-called alt-right, the white nationalist right, on social media was enormous. And so in many ways, the interventions in terms of influence missed the mark a little bit, even as some progress was made with mainstream media, things like dropping the so-called I word, the use of illegal immigrants, that phrase to characterize unauthorized immigrants in the United States was enormous success with the Associated Press, for instance. At the same time, though, we saw an explosion of right-wing and alt-right memes and misinformation through Breitbart and other news services included in social media. So that is indeed an arena of real problem for progressives and anyone who believes in that our policy debates should be rooted in factual analysis. So
right.
It is something that we need to condemn.
Right. Anytime we do try to, people do try to engage with those on the alt-right with facts, you are just met with fake news, and it's very hard to convince them to think otherwise, no matter how, you know, much grounded in reality your data might be. They have a meme to counter it. I want to thank you so much for joining us. Give out a website for Political Research Associates.
Yes. For more information, please find us at www.politicalresearch.org.
We'll post a link to that from our site later today. Thank you so much for joining us, Tarso Ramos.
Thank you, Sonali.
I'm speaking with Tarso Ramos. He is the executive director of Political Research Associates, which has produced investigative research and analysis on the U.S. right, supporting social justice advocates and defending human rights. He was in Los Angeles to speak at an event for the Stop LAPD Spying Coalition. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.